Welcome on, Senior.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show number 30 of volume 3, and it's the Depression.
That sounds pretty
depressing.
So nothing
happy about this time, but...
No, but we already saw that Father Dempsey stepped up to the plate.
Oh, Father Dempsey.
Fed over 5.5 million meals.
He's just, man, what a saint. Has anybody ever looked at his...
I don't know.
...cause for canonization?
I don't know. Yeah, right.
It's something to consider. He just worked and worked and worked to help people out.
Yeah. Well, last time around, we said that one possible solution of getting money into people's hands was through this bonus that the veterans were supposed to receive. In 1945, they would receive $1,000. The money that was set aside for them actually was $500.
Oh, they just were using the interest to get it to the thousand.
Okay. So some of the veterans said, you know, forget the $1,000. We're not going to need it in 1945. We're going to need it right now in 1932. Interestingly enough, there was one man out in Portland, Oregon, who actually attended a veterans meeting.
Okay.
And he made this suggestion. And his name is Walter Waters. And he says, I need the money now. I've got a wife. I've got two daughters. I don't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need the money now. Give us the money now. And so they sent off to Congress and asked for it. And Congress diddled and didn't respond and all. So the next meeting they had, he gets up, says the same thing. And this time around, he's got a dozen men saying, yeah, we need it now. And this went on for a while until finally they got to the point where there are 280 of them.
Wow.
280 veterans in Portland, Oregon itself, and they're demanding Congress move. And at that point, they decided, well, if Congress won't move, we'll go to Congress and make the move. And so they got on trains. Now, these are cattle cars, and these are empty cattle cars that were heading back, and Union Pacific went ahead and let them ride for free on these cars. And it becomes known as the march, the bonus march. They're not really marching.
Right.
Right. But all
but
along...
they're not riding in first class either.
No, that's right. But all along the way, wherever they went, they picked up more and more veterans who didn't have a job, so why
nothing
not?
Nothing to do, right.
Nothing to do. And so they hopped on these trains, and it grew and grew, and the sympathy was so strong. You know, when they got to Cheyenne, the local army unit there went and brought out their mobile kitchens, and they cooked hot meals for all of the veterans.
Wow.
Yeah. Later on in Council Bluffs, and the mayor came out and asked the men, they said, we've got a blood shortage. Would you be willing to donate blood? And they did in droves. It was just a beautiful response. So again, very popular. They got here to St. Louis. And the St. Louis Police Department was afraid that they were going to cause a riot.
Right.
So the department was out in full, and they had riot guns just in case and everything. And when the men got off of the railroad, they had to march over to East St. Louis to get another railroad to take them to Baltimore and Ohio. And what happens is that they all formed up into military formation, and they marched through St. Louis over to East St. Louis to get on to Baltimore and Ohio. It so impressed the chief of police that he gave Walters a $5 bill
as a donation
toward their cause. By the time they got to Washington, D.C., these 280 men became 25,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they went into parks all over the city and other neighborhoods, things, whatever, and they established something like 33 camps, military camps, for them to live. And they were orderly. There was no crime. They cooked for themselves. They took care of their latrines. They did everything in a very orderly fashion, but petitioned Congress. 25,000 men petitioned Congress for this bonus. Congress is meeting day after day, ignoring them.
Wow.
And instead, it's appropriating money to be sent out to the big banks and this group and these state governments and these city governments and all of this. And this went on and on and on for 2 months. And finally, there was an incident that took place in which some of the men had gone into a building. It was a, a building that was slated to be destroyed but had not been yet. And some of them moved in there because of the weather and all. And anyway, the long and short of it is that on July 28th, they were confronted by police who tried to evict them. And in the process, two of the veterans were shot dead. At that point, then the president gave a task to General Douglas MacArthur to clear the city out. And it's a very ugly scene. And we have footage of it. It was shown on newsreels, you know, in theaters before, because there was no television at the time. But back in those days, you could go to a movie theater and remember before you saw the film.
Before the
news. And so they saw this. They saw infantry, cavalry, even tanks moving into these 33 camps and dislodging these men, burning down their tents and burning down their camps and just tossing them out. The Congress passed an act that said that if they would leave, Congress would pay their train fare home. But the caveat was that whatever it cost for the train fare, that would be deducted from their bonus in 1945. Talk about cheesy.
Well, especially after Union Pacific had let them come down for free.
For free, yeah. So it's just a real shame. It was a black eye for the president and also for his party. And his party was really turning against him. This is 1932. It's a presidential election year. And at one point, one of his senators, Senator Hiram Johnson of California, this is a Republican, says this about the Hoover administration. It is, and I quote here, inept, futile, ineffective, inefficient, disastrous, and un-American.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. Remember William E. Borah? We'd seen him before. When Senator Borah was asked whether he would endorse Hoover, he refused to speak. And he got the nickname William the Silent for that. Here you have a situation now where Hoover is running for re-election. He's extremely unpopular. As you can well imagine, he has tried everything he possibly could. Nothing has worked. And then he's running against the governor of New York. And this is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt has a really, really tough time. It seems like it's going to be a shoo-in. But the fact is that the Democratic Party is split in two. And he's got to have to find a way to unite them. They fought with each other throughout the 1920s. They had not been a coherent party since Woodrow Wilson. And basically what happened is you have two elements within the Democratic Party. And the one group is up in the Northeast. And this is machine politics, you know, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, all that. It's urban, it's Catholic, and these are also people who are very upset about prohibition. These are the wet politicians. They want to get rid of prohibition, get back to drinking again. So that's that one half of the Democratic Party. The other half of the Democratic Party, it's Southern, it's rural, it's Protestant, and it's dry. So that's why you can't get these two groups together so that they'll actually vote for one candidate. And it turns out that Roosevelt ends up being the perfect candidate to bring these two groups together. Now, he is Northern. He's from New York, but he's Protestant. So that helps, you know. Al Smith, of course, had been Catholic. But he's a New Yorker. He's Protestant. He doesn't say much one way or the other about prohibition. He hasn't been brought into it, mainly because he's spent the last 10 years with a very low profile because he was suffering from polio. And so he was not involved in these fights. And so he's sort of a neutral character that both sides could trust. Besides that, although he's a New Yorker, he loves the South and vacations in the South all the time. So all of that worked pretty well for him. And so that's going to be the election of 1932. It's going to be a disaster for Hoover, who had had the wonderful 1928 election.
When he was the wonder boy.
He was the wonder boy, And then also another thing that's going to shift away from the Republicans is going to be African-Americans. African-Americans were very, very loyal Republicans. After all, it's the party of Abraham Lincoln. But what happened was that over the time, Republicans came to just expect the blacks would vote with or without anything that they were given. Black politicians here in St. Louis started telling Republicans, other Republicans, don't count on us. You know, you don't give us anything. All you want is a vote every 4 years or every 2 years. And so there was one in particular, one politician by the name of Jordan Chambers. Nickname was Pop. He was actually a funeral parlor director, but he really knew how to organize voters. And so he then turns around, and in the election of 1932 and then the mayoral election of 1933, he delivers the black vote to the Democratic Party. And basically, it has to do with a hospital. The Republicans had promised to build a hospital for African Americans.
Okay.
And this was going to be the Homer G. Phillips Hospital. Now, as it is, the black population in St. Louis, hospitals were segregated. And so you had a wing of city hospitals specifically set aside for black patients.
Okay.
And by and large, the nurses and the doctors were either white or black. On the other hand, St. Mary's Hospital, and you know, this is the Franciscan Sisters of St. Mary,
okay.
They had an entire section set up specifically for blacks, not only black patients, but all of the nurses were black and all of the doctors were black. Now, the importance behind that is that black nurses and black doctors need to have practice in order to get better and better. For all practical purposes, St. Mary's Infirmary for Negroes was actually the black hospital
the teaching hospital.
The teaching hospital.
Mm-hmm.
However, one thing, the head of the hospital was a sister, a religious sister.
Okay.
And she was white.
Uh-huh.
So what the African-American community in St. Louis wanted was a totally black hospital, which meant a black administrator.
Okay.
And so this is what Dieckmann, who was running for mayor, had promised them that they would do that. And sure enough, when he won the mayoral election, he then began commissioning the building of Homer G. Phillips Hospital. A lot of that was done with federal money because by this time, we'll talk a little bit about some of the alphabet agencies that helped to come in and kind of prime the pump with work. The one disappointment was that although Homer G. Phillips was built as a hospital for black patients, black doctors, black nurses, and black administrators, a teaching hospital for that, it was built by white labor. You know, there are all kinds of reasons for all of that, but it is what it is.
Where was that?
It was in the North St. Louis area called the Ville.
Okay.
Yeah, there are a number of institutions in the Ville that were really important. We'll see this later on in the 40s and 50s in particular. They were really important to the stability of that neighborhood. That is an old neighborhood that had been white, and whites had moved out. These are beautiful, nice, beautiful homes. And whites had moved out to the further west.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, between King's Highway and Union, and then Union and Skinker and mm-hmm. those areas there. And so these homes became available. For the most part, they were bought up by blacks who were professionals.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors, lawyers, mm-hmm. teachers, nurses, mm-hmm. beauticians, morticians, the professional class. And so that neighborhood was very, very stable and really very good. It also had its own high school, too, Sumner High School.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was the first African-American high school, I think, in the United States.
Okay.
I'm not sure of that, but I think so. So we have all of those things happening. I want to shift some gears here.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with anything, but all of a sudden it had everything to do with everything. and the deal is that in the summer of 1930, in Washington State, they had a bumper crop of apples.
Okay.
Massive amount of apples. Now, here's the connection. When you think about the Depression, don't you see these guys standing on the corner selling apples for a nickel?
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, well, and that's emblematic of the Depression era. Well, it all comes down to the fact that they had so many apples in Washington State, they didn't know what to do with them. And so they came up with this scheme of taking crates of apples, sending them out of Washington and Oregon, sending them by rail across the United States, and then they would have apple distributors who would distribute cases of apples. And men would come along, and they could buy a case of apples for $1.75.
Okay.
Okay. And then they would sell these apples for a nickel apiece, 5 cents apiece. And then by the end of the day, they would have earned $3. So as a result of that, they would then have a profit of $1.25.
Right.
So they've got a little money in there. You're not going to get rich off of selling apples.
No.
But you've got something. And it's going to help to provide for you and for your family. At the same time, it's getting, I was going to say getting guys off the street, but it's actually getting guys
on the street.
On the street, yeah, doing something.
But doing productive. Something.
Yeah. So as I was looking around, looking locally at this, I came across this story in Kirkwood.
Okay.
It appears in the Kirkwood Messenger, which was their local newspaper, January 22nd, 1931. It reads the following. It's really clever. It says, Kirkwood now has its Appleman figures common to this period of unemployment. The city authorities have given permission for the men, both of whom, there were two of them, both of whom were out of work and have large families, to sell their wares in and about town. And then the article goes on to tell how they sell their apples. They get their apples early in the morning. They go down to the train depot. Kirkwood Train Depot, right there on Kirkwood Drive. They sell the apples to the commuters who are going to work downtown. And so they do that. And then after the commuters have left, they take what's left of their apples, these two guys, and they go around from store to store trying to sell apples to the store owners or to the customers or whatever. And then in mid-afternoon, they head over to the high school. And they try to sell to the high school students who are coming out of school, and they're probably a little hungry. And these high school kids have a little disposable income, and so they buy the rest of the apples up. And that's how they do this day after day. Well, the article itself ends this way. It says, "It is urged that everyone that can look for and patronize these men who depend for their support of themselves and their large families upon the sale of apples."
Oh, wow.
It's a cute little story.
That's awesome. So it wasn't just New York. St. Louis.
It was all over the place, yeah. This comes from a little snippet in a history called The History of Kirkwood, Missouri, 1851 to 1865. I just found it to be fascinating. It was published in 1965. I think it's out of print now. I'm very fortunate to be an owner of it. But it was really fun to be able to read some stuff about Kirkwood history.
I almost think I keep picturing those apples in the apple chairs in Webster Groves in Old Webster. Thinking,
you know, I wonder if that's where that came from.
I was wondering that because.
Oh, I'll have to find out.
Would it have been? Yeah. That probably would have been Kirkwood at the time or not? Or was it Webster Groves?
No, Webster Groves, Webster Groves. But maybe Webster might have had their apple men also.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Because again, the train goes right through there.
Through there too, yeah.
And it stopped at Shrewsbury. Right?
Right, yeah.
And so that's just across, those chairs are right across from the highway, which wouldn't have been a highway at the time.
Yeah.
Those chairs are right there.
Huh. So. I wonder how. Well, then I'll have to pursue that.
Have to figure something out.
that's fun, yeah. So Hoover is just hanging on. He's lost the election, but you know that after the election, there's a lame duck period.
Yes.
And of course, the lame duck period has been shortened by a couple months. Back then, it went all the way until March. You know, and here he is. He is trying to talk to Roosevelt, who won the election, and trying to coordinate the lame duck session so that the two of them could do an easy handoff on all of this. And at the same time, things are getting worse and worse. There's a bank in Detroit by the name of Union Guardian Trust, and they are absolutely flat broke. Mm-hmm. And so they turn to the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, who is lending out money to great big banks. Big banks. Mm-hmm. The RFC people come in, do an audit of the bank, and they go, sorry, you don't have any collateral. How do we know that you're going to pay us back? And so with that bank failed. And then that starts a whole domino thing. Just like, you remember again, 2008 and 2009, you have Lehman Brothers is allowed to fold, and once that happens, all heck breaks loose. And this is what happens there. No sooner did that bank fail, and other banks throughout Michigan began failing, and the governor stepped in, and he declared a bank holiday. He closed all banks in Michigan. You couldn't get your money out of any bank in Michigan. Obviously, you can't get a loan, but you can't even get your own money out in all of that. Again, Hoover turns to Roosevelt and says, this is a real crisis. This is going to go nationwide. Help us out. Roosevelt never responded to Hoover.
Okay.
What he did instead was he turned around to some of his advisors. You know, they're split. Should we help? How should we help? And his response back to them was, it's not my baby.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty cold. And sure enough, all the banks in New York State closed down. Then Illinois closed down, and it looked like others were going to be doing the same. So I started looking around, and I wanted to find some local examples of this. One example I found was the niece of Father Faraday is Nini Harris.
Okay.
And does a local historian does some wonderful books. One of the books that she wrote was Unyielding Spirit, The History of the Polish People in St. Louis. And it was published by St. Stanislaus Parish. Came out in 2007. And here she tells the story of one member of St. Stanislaus, a man by the name of Max Misko. And he's got all of his money sitting in a bank, the 12th Street National Bank. He, like a lot of others, is very concerned. There are a lot of people pulling their money out and putting it into coffee cans and burying it in their backyard or underneath their, you know, their bed or whatever. He gets to the bank in order to pull his money out, and it's locked. And there's a sign on it, and it says this: although it is the brief of the board of directors of the 12th Street National Bank of St. Louis that all depositors can be paid in full, yet in view of the uncertain banking conditions in St. Louis, the board of directors deems it advisable for the protection of all the depositors to turn over the affairs of this bank to the National Bank Examiner effective this date. In other words, we're closed. Mm-hmm. Your money's safe with us. If we ever reopen.
Yes, right.
Well, it turns out that he did get some of his money back. But another member of the parish, a man by the name of Peter Switek, I don't know which bank it was in, but he had $1,500 in savings in this bank. That's a lot of money back then.
Yes.
He lost it all. The bank never reopened.
Wow.
Yeah. So those things happen. Another example of this is actually there was a program underway in the public school system, not in the Catholic school, but in public schools, encouraging kids throughout the 1920s to open up savings accounts.
Yeah, those programs still are around.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And so every Friday, kids were encouraged to go down, and something like 21,000 children participated in this. They'd go down to their local bank, and they'd put in a couple pennies, and a couple nickels, whatever they could afford. 21,000 kids had the equivalent of $96,000 in St. Louis banks.
That's impressive.
That's very wow. impressive, yeah. And then what happens, of course, these banks then do the same thing that you'd had with the 12th Street National. They closed up, and they said, oh, yeah, well, you know, when we reopen, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. Actually, the superintendent of schools, a man by the name of Henry Gerling, evidently a very wealthy man, he offered to back up those kids with a guarantee of $25,000 from him personally. So I don't know whether the kids ever got their money back or not.
Or not. But there's
that is
story. Really impressive.
Well, the fact of the matter is that when you look at this era and you look at banks, the banks lost something like $7 billion through these bank closures before Roosevelt ended up taking office. Really rough.
Really, really rough.
Yeah.
I still have to wonder if they had given some of the money to those smaller banks who knew people, they would have done a much better job with it. But who knows?
But who knows?
I hope we never have to find out how
that's for sure.
How that would work out.
So next time around, we're going to take a look at the Roosevelt administration as they come in and they do a razzle-dazzle. They've got their 100 days, they call it.
Oh, right.
Remember the 100 days.
Yes.
And every administration since then
it's
has done 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But here you really have some 100 days where a lot of stuff gets done. And a lot of it's just experimental.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it makes no difference at all. But the deal is, and this is what Roosevelt is trying, is to at least instill a sense of hope after 3 years of hopelessness.
And something to do, right?
And something to do, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, shall we close with prayer and your blessing?
Yeah. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Thank you so much, Monsignor.
Okay, sure enough.